The following is a production of the Florida State University Department of Religion. On September 6, 2013, Dr. Brian Hatcher, professor and Packard Chair of Theology in the Religion Department at Tufts University, gave a lecture on Swami Vivekananda, Practical Vedanta as Creative Theology. This lecture was followed by Swami Ishtanada of the Vedanta Center in St. Petersburg, Florida, giving a lecture on the message of Swami Vivekananda. This was presented as part of the Tessa Bartholomew's lecture series provided annually by the Department of Religion. This production is copyright to the Florida State University, Brian Hatcher, and Swami Ishtanada. All rights reserved. The runtime is approximately 2 hours and 12 minutes.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming on this Friday afternoon. We have a wonderful program for you this afternoon. Welcome especially to our guest speakers, to Dr. Brian Hatcher from Tufts University and Swami Ishtananda from the Vedanta Center in St. Petersburg. And this is the 13th annual Tessa Bartholomew's lecture, and this year we are celebrating the 150th birth anniversary of Swami Vivekananda, and we'll be hearing much more about that this afternoon. First, I'd like to ask John Kelsey, Chair of the Religion Department, to come up and say a few words.
Thanks, Kathleen, and thank you for all your work in helping to put this together. It's our practice for the Bartholomew's lecture to say a few words about the person for whom this lecture is named. Tessa Bartholomew's was our colleague in the Department of Religion from 1993 until her untimely death in 2001. Tessa was a very fine scholar. In her short time, her short career, she produced two major books. The first focused on women in Sri Lankan Buddhism. The second focused on an attempt to understand the role of Buddhist monks in the long violence that was occurring in Sri Lanka. Tessa was an award-winning teacher, a fine colleague, and a good friend, and we miss her. When she died, it was the decision of the faculty that an appropriate way to remember her would be to inaugurate a lecture series that would annually focus on a topic close to her interests. And I'm sure she would be very pleased with our topic today. As well, I think she would be pleased that the Department of Religion can collaborate, as we have in this occasion, with members of the local Indian community. And I'm very glad to see everybody turned out here today. So, welcome again. I'm going to turn things back over to Kathleen, and I hope everybody enjoys this program this afternoon.
The program this afternoon will be, first we will hear from Brian Hatcher, and then we will hear from Swami Ishtananda, and then we have a special treat this afternoon. We will have a song. If you've gotten this handout, if not, someone will come around and give you one, or you can share with those near you. We'll have a song that is based on a poem by Swami Vivekananda, and will be led in song by Mr. Srinivasa Bharadwaj Kishore. We have a reception following, so please stay as long as you possibly can. It should be a wonderful program today. Let me start by introducing Brian Hatcher. Brian received his BA from Carleton College, his MDiv from Yale University, and MA and PhD from Harvard University. He is the department chair, professor, and Packard Chair of Theology at Tufts University. He has been primarily a scholar of the Hindu tradition, modern Hinduism, in contemporary India. And in his work, he explores the complexities of cultural convergence through which idioms and practices converge to yield new patterns of thought and behavior. And he's written several books. I'll mention most notably his most recent study is called Bourgeois Hinduism, or The Faith of the Modern Vedantists, Rare Discourses from Early Colonial Bengal. And he has also translated the work of a very important thinker, Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar, and the title of that is Hindu Widow Marriage, an Epical Work on Social Reform from Colonial India. He has also recently edited a volume entitled Transcolonial Modernities in South Asia. Today he'll be speaking to us on Swami Vivekananda's Practical Vedanta as Creative Theology. Please help me welcome Brian Hatcher.
Thank you, Professor Herndl, for that kind introduction. Thank you for the Department of Religion for inviting me to speak on the occasion of the 13th annual Tessa Bartholomew's lecture. I'm really pleased and I feel honored to be here. I had the pleasure of knowing Tessa briefly when we were both in the Illinois or Midwestern region of the American Academy of Religion. I was teaching in Illinois and she was in Indiana. And our paths overlapped for a couple of years as we worked on putting together programs for the regional meetings. And I came to know her as not only a fine scholar, about which you've already heard a little bit, two wonderful books, but also a really fine human being. So she is missed, and I'm happy to sort of speak on this occasion in her memory. I don't know how much this topic would have been something she was necessarily directly interested in, but I'll do my best to enliven it for you here today. The topic of my talk is Swami Vivekananda's Practical Vedanta as Creative Theology. It was originally something I was hoping to give as a talk in New Delhi in January of this year for another commemorative event put together by Amiya Sen at Jamia Millia University, but life intervened and I wasn't able to go. So I'm happy to unveil it here today for you, and with any luck, a more substantial version of it will appear in a commemorative volume that Professor Sen hopes to bring out from Routledge in India in the coming year. So that's how I envision the future of this, but I look forward to any feedback if there's time for questions and comments as we move along. Obviously, as we celebrate Swami Vivekananda, and I hope many of you, and no doubt many of you do, know his work, know of his influence. There's so much we could say about his life, his intellectual formation, his spiritual formation. We could talk about his relationship with his master, Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. We could talk about his travels, his contacts, and the discoveries he made in the West. We could talk about his creation of the Ramakrishna Mutt and Mission and the Vedanta Society in the West, and we're fortunate to have with us today Swami Ishtananda, who represents that organization and who can speak to us after I speak. We could talk about Vivekananda's influence on modern Indian religious thought, social and political life, not to mention global developments in things like religious pluralism and interfaith understanding. And last but not least, his role in creatively framing new understandings of India and Hinduism in the modern world. There's literally so much we could say that we, by all rights, ought to dedicate a semester to this project, and we could try to run through all those things. That seems inappropriate for what I hope to be about 30-40-minute talk, so I'm not going to subject you to a quick overview of all those dimensions of his life. So I thought instead of that I would zero in on a fairly narrow topic, which is the theme of practical Vedanta, with which I hope some of you are familiar, and if not, hopefully what I'll say will intrigue you to learn a little bit more about it. It may be, in my mind, one of the most distinctive of his many distinctive teachings. something that is really indicative of his religious and his moral vision, so it struck me as an appropriate topic for the venue today. And it's been widely discussed and much debated, and I think if I have anything new to say about it, I guess I would say what I'm trying to bring attention to is captured in those two words in my title, Creative Theology. So I'll try to put those in relationship to the concept of practical Vedanta. On the one hand, I want to think with you about practical Vedanta in terms of its theological message. I propose this is somewhat of a departure from standard readings of Vivekananda, insofar as his teaching is typically understood under such rubrics, perhaps as philosophy or spirituality or religious pluralism. But maybe less often do we think of him as a theologian, per se. But as I want to suggest, if we attend to the concerns that frame the articulation of practical Vedanta, we may come to appreciate how much that teaching reflects his active engagement in thinking through a particular set of theological problems, problems that were, for him were associated with the basic notion of divine personality, or what we might call theism. And I'll say more about that in a minute. Let me suggest right now that you could think of Vivekananda as something like a comparative theologian, I think. And in that respect, he's a notable heir to the great Ram Mohan Roy, who did his work at the beginning of the 19th century in Bengal. Someone who was engaged in self-conscious intellectual reflection on his own religious commitments in light of other traditions and his own. And I borrow that as a kind of loose definition of comparative theology from Frank Clooney, who's one of the leading scholars, I think, of kind of Hindu-Christian comparative theology. So that's theology. Now, the other operative word I mentioned is creative. And it's not maybe that remarkable of an adjective, but I want to try to say what I mean there. Obviously, from all the things I began by listing at the beginning of the talk, this was an immensely creative and influential man. There's no need to belabor that point. I want to invoke the notion of creativity, though, to explore a point that I originally made in my book, Eclecticism in Modern Hindu Discourse, from 1999. In which I tried to sort through some of the intellectual habits and modes of reflection that we associate with some of India's great reformers, whether it's Mahatma Gandhi, Ram Mohan Roy, Swami Vivekananda, Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan. I was trying to think through what it was that was distinctive about their mode of thinking about Hinduism. And one of the things I settled on was the concept of poesis, creative, the act of creating, if you will, in Greek, the word from which we get words like poet and poetry. And I was trying to think through the particular ways in which these individuals went about reframing, redescribing, and redefining their tradition in light of the colonial context. And I'm particularly pleased that we'll be finishing up today with a poem written by Vivekananda. So in a very explicit sense, he was a poet, although that's perhaps not one of the first things we associate him with. We might think of Rabindranath Tagore as a poet. But in a broader sense, I want to have you think with me about Vivekananda as someone engaged in a process of creative reflection on his tradition. What we could call an ongoing, multifarious process of destruction and creation, forgetting and remembering, rejection and selection, through which the newness of modern Hinduism would emerge. And in that book that I mentioned, Eclecticism and Modern Hindu Discourse, I was trying, in a sense, to defend modern Hindu apologists who were themselves defending Hinduism. But there had been a number of essays and things written about modern Hinduism as if it somehow wasn't authentic Hinduism, as if because it had come in contact with Western thought, and because thinkers like Vivekananda had been influenced by colonial thinking, the ways they went about reframing Hinduism meant it was no longer Hinduism, or at least not true Hinduism. And that struck me as a really presumptuous argument for particularly Western scholars to make, but also for anyone to make about someone who was so deeply committed to finding the truth of his own tradition. And so I just tried to get inside the process of truth-making, if you will, that was operative for these creative intellectuals. So if we think of this creative process, and you think of Vivekananda, practical Vedanta comes to mind as something immensely new with him and immensely creative, and I'll say much more about that. But you can also think of these wonderful phrases he left us with, like man-making religion and don't-touch-me-ism when he talked about caste. He talked about the idea of God being associated with the lowest of the low, Daridra Narayana. He gave us the ways to think about Raja Yoga, etc. He was someone who creatively appropriated and re-envisioned the scriptures and the philosophies of his tradition, while at the same time redescribing for Americans and Europeans the spiritual geography of a world that at the time was besotted with evangelical fervor, imperial hubris and industrial megalomania. And he was trying to think through what it would mean to be Hindu in such a context. And this is when he gave the world Practical Vedanta. Let me introduce that concept a little bit and then explore what I want to say about it. When Swami Vivekananda returned to India in 1897 after his first tour of the United States, he did so as something of a conquering hero. That's Julius Lipner's phrase. Julius, one of the great expounders of Bengali Hinduism in the colonial period. He was widely perceived to have successfully represented Hinduism to the West and to have significantly advanced the cause of winning global respect for the wisdom of Vedanta. Whereas Vivekananda had arrived in North America in 1893 with few funds, few contacts, and scarcely a real program in mind, by the time he returned to India 4 years later, he was prepared to speak forcefully of his vision and his goals. And the work he envisioned entailed nothing short of restoring the spiritual truths of Vedanta while reclaiming that spirituality as a tool for awakening Hindians to the dignity of their heritage and their potential to become masters of their own destiny as a people. And I think, again, it couldn't be more appropriate that we have the poem Braveheart here to sing afterwards, which is an immensely inspirational poem driving toward that kind of sense of recreation of self. All right, where did I interrupt myself, right? Yeah. So in this project, he drew upon the direct experience of religious truth that he received at the feet of his master, Sri Ramakrishna, as well as upon all sorts of streams of cultural wisdom garnered through his family background, colonial schooling, exposure to religious reform movements in Calcutta, and his travels throughout India and the West. He had numerous resources and strands of influence that he would draw upon. And in some sense, with Practical Vedanta, we see all these coming together in a very short, memorable, and powerful idea, Practical Vedanta. Now, he had spoken at length about the concept of Practical Vedanta before returning to India. He had delivered four lectures under that title in London in 1896. In the first of these, he pointed out that when properly understood, Vedanta was something we ought to be able to carry out in every aspect of our lives. Upon returning to India, he began to unpack the meaning of that phrase, Practical Vedanta, for his Indian audiences. He once summed up the ideal in seven short words: give up this little life of yours. That was his summation of Practical Vedanta. On other occasions, of course, like a great scholar, he could expand on that minimal definition and give you long discourses and sophisticated philosophical expositions of what Practical Vedanta meant. And he revealed in the process the way it served as a theological platform grounded in the supremacy of an impersonal absolute and a moral teaching of self-abnegation. I'll come back to those themes. And we scarcely need to emphasize the enormous impact of this apparently simple teaching. This call to live out the experience of truth in one's daily life as a meaningful path to success was influential not only for generations of Indians responding to the first calls for national self-determination, but also to an entire world of religious aspirants who had grown fatigued by what they viewed as the rote practice of religion or the repetition of empty creeds and doctrinal assertions. And we should remember that at the turn of the century, the 20th century, it was a time of generalized spiritual ennui in the West in particular, where rapid social and economic change had unsettled the familiar habits of religion, and where scientific discoveries and new social teachings had challenged long-standing modes of belief. The time was ripe in India and in the West for someone like Vivekananda. And wherever he spoke, whether it was in the parlors of Cambridge, Massachusetts, or in the town halls across India, the seeds of Practical Vedanta fell on fertile soil. Now, rather than taking time here today to talk about the ramifications of Practical Vedanta for the shaping of nationalist aspiration or for promoting the cause of global interreligious understanding, I want to explore how Practical Vedanta can be seen to emerge from Vivekananda's creative reflections on the contemporary theology of his day, and in particular on what might call, or what might have been called at the time, the progress of theistic reform in India. Very simply, I want to argue that the concept of Practical Vedanta encodes a very clear theological position that was framed in response to at least two alternate modes of religious discourse that were operative at the time. One would have been Christianity, which had come to India in the form of missionary teachings and had been encoded in a lot of the colonial frameworks of education. And the other was the ideas of the Brahmo Samaj. We'll call them the Brahmos, the followers of Ramohan Roy, who were exponents of a form of theistic reform in India. Some of you may know the Brahmo Samaj. I'll only be able to say so much in the interest of time, but I hope what I can say at least makes it clear that they were advocating a theistic version of religion that they thought was congruent with the Hindu worldview. I hope along the way we'll see the ways in which Vivekananda's creative project built on, reacted to, and in some sense departed from the competing theological programs of the day. I'll begin with what I'll call the lure of theism. So by the time Vivekananda came of age in the late 19th century, Indians exposed to the ideology of European supremacy and educated in Christian or crypto-Christian curricula, you think of the work of Gauri Vishwanathan in her book Masks of Conquest, had come to internalize many of the basic colonial norms shaping the discourse of religion. Missionaries had promoted the idea that Indian pantheism was based in superstition and error, if not devilish deceit. Furthermore, in Christian eyes, the ritual procedures of Hindu orthodoxy, while undoubtedly ancient and sophisticated, were rendered empty of salvific content, since the Hindu conception of atonement, which does exist, did not offer the saving sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So for that very reason, had to be deficient. Furthermore, in a potent fusion of late Victorian culture and Christian exceptionalism, Christianity came to be seen as a kind of muscular religion that equipped men to be conquerors, scientists, businessmen, and philanthropists. So the hold of the colonial mindset was powerful, and it influenced the educated youth of Bengal, many of whom gravitated to movements like the Brahmo Samaj, in which they could imbibe certain traits of theistic religion without necessarily becoming Christian themselves. Missionaries often bemoan this fact, claiming that such Hindus were taking shelter in what they called a halfway house that was no longer Hindu but was not fully Christian, and they were just content to hide out there instead of take the final step. That's, of course, a demeaning way to think about what the Brahmo Samaj and other movements like it offered. My point is that those reform movements in India shaped by that colonial matrix were attractive and were imbued with these colonial ideas. Very powerful at the time. You okay? Volume?
Sorry to interrupt, but are people having trouble hearing in the back? Okay.
I'm right. Sorry. Yeah, you should yell at me.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Let me give you. This should work.
Does this one not this work?
One, two, three. You hear that? Okay. Sorry.
Take this
that one's
off.
For recording. Oh. This one's for. Can you just put that on your lapel?
I'll be doubly mic'd.
Yeah. Right. You're doubly mic'd now.
That better? Oh, excellent. Should I start over? Yeah. That's a good one, right? Now, hopefully you were with me. The point I'm making is the obvious one of what we could call Christian impact or colonial influence on the Bengali mind, if you want to put it very simply. Now, my immediate rejoinder is not to oversimplify the picture here, and as Professor Erndl suggested, the bulk of my professional career has been devoted to complicating that picture and getting rid of notions of simplistic colonial impact and Indian response, which to me basically takes care of any sort of agency on the part of the Indians themselves, takes away their creative role, and makes them mere parrots of the West. And that obviously doesn't work. The development of religious reform movements in places like Bengal was a complex process in which native intellectuals negotiated the sometimes overwhelming expression of European values using their own mastery of a wide range of indigenous resources drawn from the Indic devotional and sectarian movements, Sanskrit textual traditions, and local modes of ritual life. It would therefore be misleading to construe a reform movement like the Brahmo Samaj as a mere response to Christian influence. That would be to miss the creative agency of Indians, not to mention the continued saliency of their intellectual and institutional, not to mention moral, traditions. So if one assumes nevertheless, and I'll go back to this theme, that if you nevertheless look at where Vivekananda was in the late 19th century and he's observing the Brahmo movement, it was possible even for him to see what they were doing as a kind of native expression of Euro-Christian values. And in a sense, by the 1880s and 1890s, the apparent mimicry of colonial values by Brahmos in particular, who are sometimes characterized as Babu, the Babu culture of wearing Western clothes and adopting Western customs of living, eating, building houses, everything, that was by some Indians taken as proof of a lack of authenticity, failure to be truly Indian. Now, while early Brahmos promoted their monotheism explicitly in contrast to Trinitarian Christianity, And they drew, therefore, upon the Upanishads, which I hope some of you are aware with, looking for phrases like Ekam Eva Dvitiyam, God is one without a second, in order to promote the idea of a single creator God. Even so, as much as they drew upon their indigenous resources, you could say that their attempts to create congregational-style organizations, which they did, dedicated to weekly worship through liturgies employing scripture and song, that these owed a clear influence to Protestant models. The impress of Euro-American values, and Christian values in particular, could further be found in the Brahmo rejection of the values of renunciation in traditional Hinduism, sannyasa. Beginning with Ram Mohan Roy, they taught instead a path of worship that was consistent with life as a householder. Rather than giving up the world to go off into the forest to find God, Ram Mohan insisted that everything done in this world should be done in a spirit of dedication to God. This emphasis on the householder was later echoed in the teachings of the Tathavodhini Sabha under Devendranath Tagore, which was the subject of the bourgeois Hinduism book that Professor Erndl was kind enough to mention. Records from the early meetings of that organization, the Truth Propagating Society, if you will, in English, reveal the members' quest to worship an ultimate within the world of work and family. So to have both their worship of God and their worldly lives together. When Dabendranath and his followers thought of renunciation, they didn't want to emphasize rejection of wealth and power. They made no appeal to the idioms or the practice of classical sannyasa. Rather, they recommended what Weber might have called a more innerworldly mode of asceticism, recommending their followers merely master their passions. As they thought, if your passions were properly restrained, then you could live a pious life as a householder and achieve both worldly success and ultimate salvation. Right. This led to the development among Brahmos by 1850 or so of devotional habits and a worldly ethic whereby love of God and worldly work were of equal importance. I've called these bourgeois Hindus or bourgeois Vedantins, who highlighted the providential nature sometimes of colonial rule for actually opening up opportunities to embrace this new lifestyle. Dabendranath himself was known to invoke the mythic precedent of Shaunaka, a mythic householding sage of yore. And to his followers, Dabendranath became a kind of worldly maharshi, a worldly great seer. Under his guidance, the Brahmo path found increased integration and articulation in terms of a shared liturgy and common scriptural sources, especially by 1850 with the completion of a scripture of their own called the Brahmo Dharma. And then with the advent of Keshab Chandra Sen after 1858, the scriptural basis of truth for Brahmos began to expand to include other traditions so that Keshab said we can find religious truth around the world. But at the same time, Keshab and his followers began to look to other great men in history, among whom they identified Jesus Christ as an important figure. Keshab's attempt to recognize Christ as Asiatic was hugely influential and a powerful move, and it was complemented by the Brahmo Pratap Chandra Mazumdar's offering of an interpretation of what he called the Oriental Christ. So there was an explicit kind of attempt to embrace the figure of Jesus as a great religious figure who could be meaningful to the Brahmo community. Now, as Vivekananda scrutinized, we can imagine him at the end of the 19th century scrutinizing the institutional and hermeneutic profile of the Brahmo Samaj, what he saw, I would suggest, was a theistic sectarian movement led by a series of householder saints, if you will, that had gone through a series of schisms as authority passed from Ram Mohan to Dabendranath to Keshab, etc., and on to a younger generation of leaders who were famous for squabbling over how much of their efforts should be put into religion, how much should be put into social reform, etc. Tensions like these within the Samaj led to all kinds of divisions, the Brahmo Samaj of India, the Adi Brahmo Samaj, the Sadharana Brahmo Samaj, the Church of the New Dispensation. And so by the late 19th century, the Brahmos were could appear to be a very schismatic group. And to Vivekananda, I suggest, that proved the limits of a sort of theistic sectarianism. Okay. Now, he was equally troubled, I think, by the ways in which these Brahmos seemed drawn to Christianity. And he noted that people like Pratap Chandra Mazumdar and Keshab had sparked significant interest amongst liberal Christians in the West. He noted that his contemporary Bhavanichar and Bandopadhyay even embraced Christianity and took up the name Brahmo Bandab, which was his Sanskritized version of Theophilus, the friend of God. To Vivekananda, what such people were doing, in the words of one scholar, was strategically and treacherously offering Christianity the very tools it needed to subvert Hinduism. It's an extreme way of putting it, but it betrays the anxiety he might have felt looking at what appeared to be an almost overt embrace of Christianity. While Vivekananda was willing to admit the benefits wrought by British colonial rule in terms of trade and commerce, he also clearly refused to adopt a set of theological principles that would work to weaken Indians and divide them against themselves. This theme of schism there. If the strength of the English lay in their endless self-confidence, then Indians needed to be taught the same message of self-confidence. This would not come from aping the West. It called for what Vivekananda called an upheaval in religion. This upheaval is what I want to describe in terms of a creative redescription or a kind of poesis. And in this, practical Vedanta was central. And I want to say it was accomplished by promoting three interrelated claims, which I'll review with you now. First, that Advaita Vedanta is superior to theistic religion. Second, that the life of the renouncer is superior to that of the householder. And third, that the truth embodied by Ramakrishna is superior to that of any personal god. So I'll work through these in order. Advaita Vedanta, then. If one listened to the Christians and the Brahmos, one learned it was essential to believe in a personal creator god who was the moral governor of the universe and the ultimate locus of truth. While the Vedantic theism of the Brahmos stopped short of affirming the saving role of God sacrificed in Christ, the Brahmos shared the key theological premise that God created the world and the laws that we should obey. Failure to submit to these laws constituted a falling away from truth. Vivekananda summed up this theological position in one of his lectures. Here he is speaking about theism, if you will. He said, "The idea of the personal God is that he is the omnipresent, creator, preserver, and destroyer of everything, the eternal father and mother of the universe, but one who is eternally separate from us and from all souls, and liberation consists in coming near to him and living in him," end quote. I think we can say that characteristic to his kind of creative reflections, Vivekananda liked to turn this picture on its head. He said that far from being a key to salvation, recognizing such an all-powerful creator God was actually the root of the problem. The requirement that we submit ourselves to God smacked of just that, submission. Vivekananda was troubled by the apparent homology between the idea of submitting to a God who was other and the idea of submitting to foreign rule and the colonizer's religion. If India was in need of a religion that promoted self-respect, strength, and dignity, he questioned how such a posture of submission could be a path to take. Recognizing that the Christians and the Brahmos had deployed the concept of atheism as a tool to frame the superiority of their theologies, everyone else was atheist, he again turned the tables around and challenged their definition of atheism. And his logic is simple and effective. In Vedanta, he says, one celebrated not the otherness of God, but the divinity of the human soul. And as such, for Vedanta, atheism consisted, as he put it, in not believing in the glory of our own soul. So he redefines atheism in a new way. And in that one interpretive move, he threw the theists into the position of error. The highest truth was not a personal God, but the impersonal God of Vedanta. I read you here from his lecture on Vedantism. And what are our relations with this impersonal being? That we are he. We and he are one. Everyone is but a manifestation of that impersonal, the basis of all being, and misery consists in thinking of ourselves as different from this infinite impersonal being. And liberation consists in knowing our unity with this wonderful impersonality. Now, Vivekananda knew that both Christians and Brahmos understood their personal God to be the giver of commandments, the judge of right and wrong, the one compass point guiding ethical behavior. And just as he had redefined the meaning of atheism, he turned this concept of monotheistic ethics on its head by saying that the true practice of love and charity required recognition not of the personal God, but of an impersonal God, saying, "It is only through the idea of the impersonal God that you can have any system of ethics," end quote. The ethical core of Advaita Vedanta for him consisted of acknowledging the inherent divinity of others. As he put it again, in quote, "You understand it when you learn that the whole world is one, the oneness of the universe, the solidarity of all life, that in hurting anyone, I'm hurting myself, in loving anyone, I'm loving myself," end quote. This was not just preaching a kind of soft version of love It was also a teaching about dignity and strength. For Indians to become strong, they needed to abandon the self-denigrating posture of theistic submission and stand firm in their own spiritual wisdom, in their dignity as Indians and as individuals. This is the key to what he called man-making religion. And there's a wonderful quote from his lecture on Vedantism that I feel I should read. I hope I'm not taking too much time. "I am the impersonal being of the world. What can make me afraid? I care not even for nature's laws. Death is a joke to me. Man stands on the glory of his own soul. This glorious soul we must believe in. Out of that will come power, whatever you think that you will be. If you think yourselves weak, weak you will be. If you think yourselves strong, strong you will be." This is a very powerful message, and even deliberately, perhaps assertive, death is a joke to me. But he's making a very powerful counterpoint to the theism of his day. For him, the benefits of acknowledging the impersonal God stem not only from the ennobling affirmation of a glorious soul, but also from the fact that, unlike theistic movements, the truth of Advaita Vedanta fostered harmony and unity rather than divisiveness and schism. What he called the broadening and ennobling ideals of Advaita Vedanta set it apart from theistic religions, which to him smacked of tribalism and conflict. The religion of Advaita Vedanta was one of inclusion. No one was ever excluded from it, he said. He, as I said, he came of age in a day when the Brahmos were fighting one another, when schism was the word of the day, which led people to say, he sort of characterizes this in one phrase, "My God is true, yours is not true, let's have a good fight over it." Right? He placed the blame for such internal disunity at the door of the Brahmo leaders themselves, claiming that whenever a householder became the leader of a sect, he necessarily began to serve his own interests. In his mind, this could only lead to competition and disunity. In characteristic fashion, he stated, quote, it's hyperbole perhaps, but it's toward a rhetorical point, "all religious movements headed by householders have shared the same fate of schism and disunity. The only solution to this problem lay in a proper understanding of renunciation. Without renunciation," he said, "religion can never stand." So that takes us to the theme of renunciation. Now, at first glance, the decision to return to an explicit ideal of renunciation seems like a radical break with the Brahmos. However, on at least one level, his thinking was actually fairly close to the Brahmo ideal, if you look at it. He drew on the teachings, in particular, of Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, making a case for imbuing ordinary existence with the virtues of tyaga, or renunciation. Krishna, after all, revealed the beauty of this worldly renunciation. He was both sannyasin and householder. Krishna reveals there's no need to run from the world to find spiritual fulfillment. Instead, the goal should be to do one's work while renouncing claims predicated on your own selfish identity. Like Dabendranath and the Brahmos, Vivekananda offered something like a qualified endorsement then of renunciation. As he put it, Vedanta teaches renunciation of sense enjoyment and detachment from this petty world of attachment, not necessarily isolation in a cave or wandering off to be a beggar. This renunciation that he promoted enshrines the notion of a revised vairagya, a kind of renewed sense of dispassion, which is at the heart of practical Vedanta. Practical Vedanta promotes a life of simple abnegation. And that's the context in which to understand his brief summary of practical Vedanta that I gave you earlier. I'll read you a slightly longer version. "If you want to help others, your little self must go. Here is practical Vedanta before you. Give up this little life of yours." That is itself an act of renunciation, giving up your own attachment to yourself. Now, as he saw it, the problem was not that the world was inherently dangerous to spiritual practice, as you get in the ancient Upanishads and the traditions of Buddhism and Jainism, in which desire in the world leads to attachment and one needs to do radical things to escape from it. We don't need to abandon the world as much to come to understand it in the light of Advaita Vedanta. He liked to say that he had not renounced the world. What he renounced was a world that had not been sufficiently divinized. A wonderful turn again. This is his creative knack, I think. Suggesting that he shared with the Brahmos a certain distaste for radical renunciation, since it threatened to turn people away from engagement with the world. Yet in his call to divinize the world, we see how far he departs from the Brahmos, who kept their divine at a distance in the form of a theistic personal creator god. Now, we all know, and Swami Ishtananda can attest to the creation that Vivekananda created an institution based on the rituals and bodily practice of renunciation among the early disciples of Ramakrishna. He dedicated the life of these new holy men to the service of others. The monks of the Ramakrishna Mutt and Mission would be living reminders of practical Vedanta. And as Rini Bhattacharya Mehta points out, this reformation, reformulation, if you will, of renunciation in terms of service, in her words, broke new political ground insofar as it offered a new idiom of what she calls ascetic activism that would enable celibate monks and nuns to partake in organized efforts for things like the eradication of poverty, disease, and illiteracy. Very different engagements for what we think of as world-renouncing monks. In their vows, these new monks embodied the highest ideals of humility and self-abnegation, even as they pledged themselves to service, making them striking representatives of practical Vedanta and setting them apart from the householder sages of the Brahma movement. His monks, he said, must first and foremost learn to serve. Only then would they be fit to be a master. And this brings me to the third and final theme, that of the master, Ramakrishna, and I'll turn to that. For Vivekananda, there had really been only one true master who embodied all the ideals he sought to promote through the teaching of practical Vedanta, and that was, of course, Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa, the remarkable mystic saint who revealed the living heart of true religion. Although the concept of practical Vedanta was not part of Ramakrishna's spiritual or didactic repertoire, Vivekananda nonetheless looked to him as the focal point and perhaps the catalyst for his own vision of religious truth. Bear in mind, Ramakrishna may have been just a simple temple priest who rarely ventured beyond the precincts of Dakshineshwar, where he served the goddess Kali. He may have often dismissed the idea of serving humanity as a distraction from spiritual sadhana. And I know this well because the man I've dedicated much of my career to working on, Ishar Chandra Bidyasagar, who wrote the tracts in support of widow marriage, had a famous conversation with Ramakrishna. And Ramakrishna basically called into question all the efforts Bidyasagar had put into changing the world, suggesting it would be far better to work on achieving ultimate knowledge of God. So there was aspects of Ramakrishna that were decidedly not about serving others. And yet, in a way, for Vivekananda, he embodied the ideal. He appears to be, in some sense, a rather inappropriate model for the activist holy men of Vivekananda's movement, and yet it was in his name and for his glory that Vivekananda fashioned this theology and this social ideal of practical Vedanta. And how he did this is kind of interesting, and that's what I want to sum up with at the end here. He had a theory of the way great sages had operated in world history, and you can read this in a variety of discourses, in particular his discourse, The Sages of India. Here he places Ramakrishna in the lengthy succession of India's holy men, remarking that Ramakrishna was yet another of the brilliant ones, or epoch makers, who had placed a stamp upon India's religious heritage. And in order to help understand the contribution of these sages, Vivekananda began one address by pointing out how all the Vedas taught an impersonal God. He noted that the Vedas actually featured the names of many great sages, though. But at the same time, they never gave you many details about those sages' lives. And for him, that was a reminder that the significance of the sages was always framed in relation to this impersonal higher truth. And that's what sets Vedanta apart in his mind from other religions. He pointed out how other religions trace their origins to the lives and exemplars of particular historical individuals, the Buddha, Christ, Muhammad. But because Vedanta teaches an impersonal truth, it's not contingent upon any historical individual. It therefore rises to the level of a truly universal religion. Now, you could say it looks like he's running the risk of painting himself into a corner by stressing Vedanta's independence from the role of any individual personality. That doesn't seem like a good angle to take if you're about to say, I was influenced by Sri Ramakrishna. But he addresses that concern by turning to the same tradition of sages. And he says they've existed from time immemorial. Their stories are enshrined not just in the Vedas, but in the Smritis and the Puranas and all the other texts. Stories that reveal it to us that ordinary humans have always found it necessary to turn to the figure of a powerful teacher or guide. Recognizing this, India's sages, he says, left it open that truth could be incarnated from age to age. And here he turns again to the Bhagavad Gita and Krishna's teaching of the doctrine of avatara, or loosely incarnation, or the descents of God into the world. India's myths and scriptures reveal that throughout the millennia, people have found great sages that they can honor and emulate. That could be Rama, could be Krishna, could be Shankaracharya, could be Ramanuja, Chaitanya, etc. And so on down to the present day, when the one man appeared in the very fullness of time near the one city in India that he writes was full of Western thought, a city which had become more Europeanized than any other city in India, end quote. Though unlettered, this man had the probing intellect of a Shankaracharya. Even English-educated university graduates journeyed to his home and fell at his feet. Even though this man had not the benefit of a colonial schooling or Christian moral improvement, he nevertheless possessed the expansive heart of a Chaitanya, demonstrating acceptance of all, high-born and low-caste alike. This man, of course, was Ramakrishna, modern India's answer to the challenges of westernization, theistic reform, and sectarian squabbling. He was the sage who pointed to the same impersonal God at work behind every sect. He pointed to the manifestation of the one impersonal God in every human being. So to conclude, through an examination of these three elements then of practical Vedanta, the supremacy of Advaita Vedanta, the role of renunciation, and the figure of Ramakrishna, I want to suggest that we should see there's a distinctive and immensely consequential idea that emerges here from Vivekananda's creative appropriation and appropriation of, let's say, and debate with central theological themes that had emerged during the course of elite reform in 19th century India. We can see in particular how closely he studied and reflected upon the teaching of his sometime friends and cohorts in the Brahmo movement, and how much he used his understanding of both those Christian and Brahmo movements to articulate in a creative way his own message of Vedanta. And I think it's important to remember that insofar as we don't make him someone who's sui generis or who popped out of a puff of smoke, but he comes to us historically in a context with which he worked. He owed something to the Brahmos, even if he felt the need to distinguish his position from theirs. He owed them the credit of opening up India to a larger world and of making Hindu religion a fit subject for rational critique. He himself acknowledged that, and he recognized on occasion figures like Ram Mohan Roy for those very reasons. You can look at his address at Calcutta. Likewise, beginning with Ram Mohan, the Upanishads and Vedantic traditions more broadly were placed front and center in the work of religious reformation in places like Calcutta. Ram Mohan's engagement with Shankara, even as he distanced himself from the pure position of Advaita, could be said to have set in motion a century's worth of reflection on what could be found in the classical system of Vedanta and put to use in the new context. And in that context, renunciation was front and center as an issue. We've seen that the Brahmos rejected world renunciation both as a personal style and as a moral teaching. While Vivekananda brought the figure of the sannyasin back to the fore, he did so only in the light of genuine reservations about renunciant isolation and moral indifference. He may have chided the householder leaders of movements like the Brahmo Samaj, but in the end, practical Vedanta offered a meaningful reconciliation of worldly engagement and renunciant commitment. The order of renunciant but socially active sadhus he created are the embodiment of this combination of renunciation and engagement. Finally, without gainsaying the obviously transformative influence of Ramakrishna over Vivekananda's life, it can be said that even Vivekananda's portrayal of his beloved master owes a debt to the moral and theological work of his Brahmo forebears. It was the Brahmos, after all, who generated new scriptural and hermeneutical tools for thinking about the role of religious leaders. Here again, Ram Mohan had sort of paved the way by making room within his reformed worldview for the significance of a figure like Jesus. Ram Mohan famously going back and editing the Gospels in order to make them more rationally acceptable. A very bold move for its time. Right? Once again, Jesus Christ could become an important figure then in the Brahmo imaginary, and he would reemerge, as we have seen in later Brahmo writings of Keshab and Protap Chandra Mazumdar, for whom he represented the figure of a great man and a beacon of Asiatic spirituality. One of the great people to promote that was Keshab Chandra Sen. And here's another one of the great ironies here, is that it was Keshab who introduced the young Narendranath Dutta, who would go on to become Swami Vivekananda. It was Keshab who introduced Narendranath to Sri Ramakrishna. And in so doing, Keshab inadvertently set his friend on a path to spiritual awakening and subsequent glory as a promoter of Ramakrishna's vision and teachings. Beyond this, we could say that Keshub also inadvertently provided Vivekananda with an interpretive framework within which to situate the advent of Ramakrishna. In Vivekananda's writings, Sri Ramakrishna, as we've seen, became one of India's great men, a sage who had incarnated himself along the logic of Krishna's own example. And for Vivekananda, chafing under the impression of hopeless Indian subservience to the West, Ramakrishna offered a compelling alternative to the Christ of the missionaries, or of the Brahmos for that matter. In his creative makeover of Ramakrishna, from rustic pujari to world historical incarnation, we can discern Vivekananda's attempt to counter the efforts of Brahmos, who at that very time were promoting Christ as the embodiment of universal religion. So that's, I think, an important point to remember as we think about this creative moment. So if the revived Vedanta promoted by Vivekananda was to be recognized as the true universal religion, even the fundament of religion itself, it could not be traced to Christ. It required a stamp of approval from an Indian sage who embodied what Vivekananda called the impersonal personal God. And that sage was Ramakrishna. He was the perfect figure, embodying Vivekananda's answer to the theists, the personal manifestation of impersonal truth, selfless devotion, and religious harmony. He was the very avatar of practical Vedanta. The yoking of the concept of practical Vedanta to the life and teaching of Sri Ramakrishna may thus have been the key to the ultimate success of Vivekananda's creative theological program. Thank you.
And Mr. Srinivas is now going